So good afternoon to all of you. Thank you for attending. Probably more than I even expected, so thank you for your support for this event, this lunchtime seminar. My name is Jürgen Hake. I'm the director of the Salisbury Hawk Southeast Asia Center here at LSE. I'm also a faculty member in the International Relations Department at the school. It's my great pleasure today to welcome Dr. Ghanashyam Winaraja, who is an advisor in the Economic Research and Regional Cooperation Department at the Asian Development Bank, and was formerly the director of research of ADB of the ADB Institute in Tokyo. Before then, of course, you've also worked in various other capacities, which I won't go into now, but I think it's clear that you have a very distinguished past career before joining the ADB. He's worked on many issues to do with trade liberalization, development thinking, strategies for regional integration, but this talk today will really be about infrastructure. And it's based on a book that Dr. Winaraja published fairly recently, which is called The Infrastructure for Integrating South and Southeast Asia, published in, I think, in 2016.
Correct.
Thank you very much for joining us today and for doing this. Actually, I need to move.
Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you so much for coming. I'm really grateful to the Salisbury Hawk Southeast Asia Study Center and Director Jürgen for having me here. And I thought we'd talk about this very provocative topic, is regionalism passé? And then we can talk about infrastructure. And the context for this is, I think, a very interesting one. I mean, in the last 30 years that I've been looking at global economic integration, I don't think we've had a time where we've had such a big set of crises that are coming together in a multiple way, challenging globalization. We have world trade growth that is growing slower than world GDP growth. And remember, in the past, world trade growth was twice as fast as world GDP growth, right? So that was kind of the big motor of globalization. We have rising protectionist tendencies that are coming in place with President Trump's America First policy. We have Brexit, which talks about the big shock of Britain leaving the European Union and the consequences of that. We have skepticism in the World Trade Organization. We have disruptive technological change with artificial intelligence and robotics. And some people, because of these types of changes, are saying, well, globalization is dead. Okay, so they're beginning to write the obituary of globalization. So the question today is regionalization also passé as part of the same process? Or is there something else in Southeast Asia in particular, an infrastructure that brings regionalism in a different way to look at the world? And so that's what I really want to talk to you a bit about. And can we really think of this new form of infrastructure-led integration as a kind of a model coming out of Southeast Asia and Asia and the role of the People's Republic of China? Now, infrastructure is obviously a hot topic today. We're talking about the role of infrastructure in inclusive growth in Asia and infrastructure as a vehicle to create jobs across borders. We're talking about the creation of a new set of regional development banks in Asia, the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank, the new development bank led by China, the Silk Road Initiative, a number of new institutions. There's also talk about this big infrastructure funding gap, $8 trillion or something like that, which exists in Asia. So there are all these kind of big issues that are there. And so the book that I'm going to be talking about was really bringing one part of that project about connecting South and Southeast Asia. And I'm going to try to talk more about the Southeast Asia part. And that looked at a number of things. It looked at the benefits of connecting South and Southeast Asia, and I'll show you how we try to model that. It looked at the costs in a particular bottom-up way of looking at costs. So we had a transport expert who went and looked at all the possible missing links in infrastructure, road, rail, ports, and then costed out the particular projects that could occur. So that was a very interesting aspect. And then we looked at the policy coordination and the financing also of this proposal, and a little bit at regional trade agreements. The book is published by Edward Elgar and available free. I'll give you the link in a minute. You can download it from the website. The way the ADB and the ADB Institute did the financing of the book meant this is a public good, so you all can all download it. So don't worry so much about the notes, unless you want to. And I co-edited the book with Michael Plummer, who's at Johns Hopkins SAIS in Bologna campus. He's the director there. And Peter Morgan, who's at the ADB Institute in Tokyo. So this is the product I want to talk to you today. And the background really is this question of, is regionalism a viable vehicle, particularly in a bottom-up way led by infrastructure, right? And it's no longer about trade agreements, but the hard stuff, right? And the soft stuff will be very important in the future. Let me start about why do we care about South and Southeast Asia? And there are probably a whole set of reasons, and let me try to bring the context out a little bit. The first is that Asian growth is coming down a little bit, so this sort of 7-8% growth rates that we saw in the region across China in particular are probably going to moderate, and China is down to 6%. Some people are thinking of 5% in the future. So there's a need to look at new sources of growth, and India in particular is projected to grow at 7% this year and next. Southeast Asia is chugging along at somewhere between 4 and 5, depending on the country. So that's an important reason to look at these kind of two big growth poles apart from China. Then we have the ASEAN Economic Community project, which is supposed to create a single market and economy and production base for 600 million people across the 10 Southeast Asian nations. And this project was a project in the making for many years, but 2015 was an important watershed where, you know, there was a formal launching of this program. And now they're talking about, you know, a decade beyond this and what hopes to be done. So if everything works, we have a single market economy where trade and investment can flow nicely, and eventually people. And there's a challenge with the people part, of course. India, as we all know, has had a pro-business government for a couple of years under Narendra Modi, and he's particularly keen on acting east. So that's something different. Looking east was an earlier policy that they brought into being. When India liberalized in 1991, they also had the Look East policy, right? And the criticism of the Look East was that it was a lot of talk and not much happened in terms of diplomacy. And so Mr. Modi has been talking about acting east. And indeed, in his first sort of overseas mission, he went to Japan, and there was a lot of talk of Japanese investment coming to India and so on. So that's a very important issue, and India has tried to launch a next set of reforms. We have the monetization of the rupee, of course, which was a big controversial project. And the jury's out as to whether that was a good thing or a bad thing, but there was certainly a big short-term impact. But he seems to be keen to move forward, particularly on the FTA front with Southeast Asia. And then we have Myanmar, and I understand from Jogan that you had a talk here yesterday on Myanmar, and you know that's seen as the key bridge and the key land bridge to connect South and Southeast Asia. And the opening up of that means that the reform side is much more doable. The question is, can the infrastructure connectivity happen? And the point, I guess, of the talk is that with the right policy actions, South and Southeast Asia integration can become a reality. So here's a sense of the trade flows. As you can see earlier on, the numbers were very small. We're talking about, you know, under 10, 12 billion South and Southeast Asia. And these are two-way flows. So the blue is the South Asia with Southeast Asia, and the red is the Southeast Asia with South Asia. And, you know, basically, they tell you the same thing, but this is the two-way trade. Numbers are going up, and there's a big jump, particularly since the global financial crisis, right? So as developed countries, United States and Europe, were in recession, there was a sense that Asia might come up and take up some of the slack in the world economy, and you can see a little bit of a bump, but these numbers are still very small, right? They're 100 billion, you know, even if you add it and look at it both ways, not very big numbers, but there's a jump. Yeah, so that's the nice part. If you take the numbers forward, there's a little bit more of upward movement. Now, you must remember, this period sees trade in Asia beginning to slow. So it's remarkable that South and Southeast Asia have had some buoyancy upward. But the numbers should be 2-3 times that, and that's the contention that we had in being, given the potential of this enormous region. Southeast Asia has realized that South Asia is somewhat closed compared to Southeast Asia. If you remember, there are many tariff barriers. There's the asymmetrical issue of India being the large economy and the others being much smaller. Intra-regional trade within South Asia is quite small. In Southeast Asia, inter-regional trade ratios are something like 25%. Okay, so Southeast Asia does quite a bit of trade with itself, but they also do a lot of trade with Northeast Asia and the rest of the world. So they're slightly different regions, but together they could be potentially very important. So the book itself tried to look at connectivity, and particularly the role of infrastructure and public policies, and it had 13 chapters covering a lot of interesting things. There was land and sea transport, there was infrastructure investment financing, we had soft infrastructure on trade facilitation, we had coordination, we tried to look at the benefits, and we had a series of country studies. I mean, this was a major research project of the ADB Institute along with the Asian Development Bank, and what's contained in the book, which I shall give you the link, is really the background papers. So that's the edited book from Edward Elgar, but there's also an ADB corporate report which tried to look at this from an operational point of view, and then there's several journal articles as well as policy pieces in the Nikkei Asian Review and so on, which you can read. So we tried to make this a little bit of a mega project, and we got real experts looking at land and sea and transport. So we got the world's best seaport person, one of the best transport people in Asia, very good trades facilitation person. We did general equilibrium modeling of benefits. We looked at the project costs. We tried to get someone on finance to give us a sense of this. So we tried to do the best thing that we thought was technically possible within the realm of 18-month project. Okay, and I think you'll find it very interesting when you start looking at it. Let me just try to give you a sense of it. Here was the team. So Mike Plummer, Peter Morgan, and I edited the book and tried to pull it all together. And here are some of the names of the different people that are involved. And I played a role with Mike and others on the modeling side of the benefits. But we got national people involved and so on. And so it was a really interesting exercise. And rather than just looking at the overview chapter and some of the findings, I recommend that you all also look at the country chapters for getting a sense of the richness of what happened in India or in Sri Lanka or in some of the other Southeast Asian countries. And we picked these partly based on our operations colleagues at the ADB. I mean, we didn't have all the countries, of course, right? But we had in the cross-country chapters, we covered as much as we could. Yeah? So these were more detailed studies to give us more detailed issues. Okay, let me give you a sense of the main findings. That might be interesting. So the first kind of big issue that we discovered was that the potential gains, and this was estimated using a computable general equilibrium model, which for those who are familiar with it is a multi-country global model that has about 40 sectors and indeed all the countries of the world, and they have trade flows, they have tariffs and non-tariff barriers, you can bring in transport costs. And you basically shock this model to see what would happen if you create different types of arrangements. And you get some interesting numbers that come out. So the big gains are something like practically $600 billion of the total welfare gains that you would get by bringing South Asia and Southeast Asia together in some kind of infrastructure-led scheme. And then we found that the gains were particularly large on the South Asian side. And South Asia gets big numbers in terms of the gains. $300 billion, some 8% of GDP potentially. Southeast Asia, the gains are a bit smaller in absolute magnitude terms. And if you think of the population issues and so on, probably South Asia should benefit. But also the distortions. Remember, you reduce all the trade barriers in this and you look at the transport and other areas for potential. So it's an interesting story, but when you look at the costs further down the track, you'll see that Southeast Asia has to invest a bit more disproportionately compared to South Asia. So there's this interesting asymmetric issue as to whether this project would be there. So South Asia sees more of the gains in absolute terms, but they invest less to get those gains. Southeast Asia sees slightly less gains overall, but they have to invest more. And I'll show you the numbers of that. A lot of that is to do with the rail connectivity. And I'll explain the issue of the different modes of transport, and it becomes really quite fascinating. To be honest, when we started this work, I didn't know very much about these different modes or these things, but from the experts, we learned a lot, and it's a fascinating area to look at. And ultimately, you come up with the idea of a multimodal system. Anyway, So here was how we tried to do this, and there is a paper in the Asian Economic Papers, which is published by MIT Press, if you're interested in the technical detail on this, and I'll give you the references in a minute. And we tried to have different scenarios, and for our purposes, we had basically a deep integration scenario, and we had three components of this. We had the first was just the removal of all tariffs associated with South and Southeast Asian trade, and that's what usually is done in CG exercise. They're a fairly simplistic way of doing it. But as we know, tariffs have all come down to around 8% in Asia as a whole. So the shock you'll get with this and the gains are probably quite small. So trade liberalization has kind of done its thing in the tariff sense. This is far more of an issue. Non-tariff barriers are the big form of protection today. And non-tariff barriers, phytosanitary standards, technical barriers to trade, anti-dumping, customs and borders issues, trade facilitation, this is the big area of gain. And we assume there would be a 50% reduction in NTBs, in reducing the trade between barriers to South and Southeast Asia trade. And then we thought we'll get a significant gain if we reduce the trade costs. So this is to do with the trade facilitation, the customs modernization, the single window project that is talked about in Southeast Asia and indeed quite advanced. And so if you bring in tariffs, non-tariff barriers, and trade facilitation, this was the kind of shock that we thought. Now, there are many things we can't model in the infrastructure proposal, I should say that. And CG models have a number of simplifying assumptions, such as perfect competition. They can't really take into account dynamic effects so much, except in a partial sense and so on. But, you know, you get something, which is an interesting. So the numbers we get for the gain side is somewhat conservative. Okay, that's the point I want to make. And you get interesting numbers by country. So here's a sense of different scenarios. And look at the this scenario, which I think is the best one. And that kind of typifies what I was showing you before. So if you give this kind of reduction of all the tariff barriers, 50% of non-tariff barriers, and 15% reduction in trade costs, you get these kinds of benefits. Okay, and these are long-run numbers. These are not one-shot numbers. These are kind of long-run. And typically, you get those gains for South Asia, and much of this happens in this way. And the small countries get a lot of the benefits. That's the interesting part. Okay, so Nepal, Bhutan, Maldives, they get a lot. Now, is that a data issue, or is that because genuinely small countries are less connected? I mean, Maldives is sea-locked, right, and there are lots of islands. Nepal is landlocked. Okay, so one wonders part of that issue. But this is what the numbers show you, and the gains happen both on trade as well as investment. Let me talk a little bit about Southeast Asia, since we are at the Southeast Asia Studies Center, and these are the kind of benefits that you get. Big gains in Philippines, something for Singapore. So these three get quite a bit, along with Malaysia. Okay. Indonesia sees some gains. Laos is at the fringes of this proposal, so it doesn't get so much. Cambodia is also at the fringes, but Vietnam gets a big gain. And Vietnam is probably one of the most interesting countries in Southeast Asia. It's got probably one of the most dynamic production bases. Its exports are growing faster than any other country in Southeast Asia. Labor costs are very competitive relative to productivity. Infrastructure and government coordination is very good. So it comes with our priors. It comes with our priors. And you see these partly in the trade numbers. So it's interesting what you get, but simulations are as good as the assumptions that you make, right? So that's something to bear in mind, but it gives us something as opposed to our gut feeling. We get some kind of framework to look at these things consistently. Okay. Let me talk about this, which is kind of more interesting. So what we did was we had our transport and our roads and our ports and our railway and our energy people look at the issue of the missing links. What are the impediments to these types of things connecting across borders between South Asia and Southeast Asia? Okay. And the interesting number that they came up with was, so remember, $568 billion worth of benefits, you know, some big number like that. The cost is small, one-fifth, $73 billion in monetary terms. Okay. And much of this was rail. And the road was a bit less, imports were a bit less, and energy was another one. Now, the railway is interesting. Railway is the cheapest way per unit of transporting bulk goods. Okay, one of the cheapest ways. Okay, but the cost of the infrastructure is very high. Yeah. And railways have a lot of problems across South and Southeast Asia. I mean, even in Southeast Asia, you have, you know, different railway track gauges, right? So which means the transport systems go at different rates. So incompatible gauges, incompatible standards, incompatible rolling stock. Some of it's Soviet, right? In the Laos, Vietnam, Cambodia, a lot of that was Soviet stock or Chinese stock in the more recent times. In Southeast, the more developed Southeast Asia countries, Malaysia, Thailand, and so on, a lot of that is Japanese, and so on. So immediately you see the problems, right? High-speed rail, somewhat non-existent, except between Singapore and Thailand and a few of the other countries, although now China and Japan are trying to do some of this. So you see some of the interesting issues that come up. And the red here tells you what South Asia has to invest, and the blue tells you what Southeast Asia has to invest. And the big issue is the railway part in Southeast Asia. Okay. So here's an actual costing, and we have a policy brief on ADB website. Go ahead.
Just a question. What is energy trading?
This is to do with the energy corridor. So it's renewable energy. So it's not the generation. It's the infrastructure around the trading. I've got a slide on that in a minute, if you'll.
Yeah,
that's right. I've got a slide which I'll talk about in a minute. But it was hard to measure the actual power generation. And that would have been national projects. So we tried to look at those projects that were regional. So just to pick the road example, which is an easier one. So if there are roads on a border that are part of a major trade route, we counted that as a regional project, okay, which was then going to connect more than two countries. And so it's a similar idea here. So this is not everything within each sub-region, but this is the stuff on the borders. Okay. So if you want to improve the infrastructure in South Asia or Southeast Asia, the bill would be much, much bigger. Okay. This is just the stuff you need to get the cross-regional stuff going. Yeah, is that clear? So I'll talk about this in a minute. I've got a slide. That's a great question. So what we did was we had these experts looking at all the projects and the bottlenecks, and they tried to estimate, you know, what were the possible projects that we had to do. And we have a policy brief on this if you're interested. If you download, use my name and the Peter Morgan and Mike Plummer's name, and you talk about infrastructure projects, you'll actually get a list of projects and the details of it and so on. So that's also on the web. And this was the new infrastructure, okay, and a bit of upgrading, but they don't include the cost of infrastructure within each sub-region. Okay? I mean, India alone, $73 billion is probably part of one state, okay, what you need to do. Okay, so I just wanted to mention that. Here's some way of trying to answer the question that was asked. So in terms of this infrastructure, look at the two regions, a lot of this is the problems in Myanmar. Yeah? And that's why Myanmar coming to the fold is such an interesting thing. And Myanmar, you know, was a less developed country. It had a long history of socialist orientation, underfunding of a lot of infrastructure, very low capacity, right, to implement and set up projects. So a lot of this comes in. But when you look at this thing cross-regionally, you also see issues in Bangladesh, in Laos, in Thailand, and in Vietnam, and in Cambodia. So in terms of the road and rail links, these are some of the issues. And here we're talking about, two-lane highway type things that can move the trucks very fast across borders. Okay? So that's a big issue here. And there are lots of bits that are missing. I'll show you some maps in a minute, which will probably clarify some of the points. In railways, these are some of the issues I was talking about. Yeah? And you know, if we're thinking of high-speed rail, that's probably many years away, apart from some routes. But there are some significant issues in this. And then this is the de facto. Given that the land route has all these problems, this is how the trade takes place. So it's about the ports that are terribly important. There are three regional ports that are particularly important. Kolkata in India, Chittagong in Bangladesh, and Yangon. And there are lots of capacities. You know, a lot of these ports can't take the big ships, the big container ships. they have capacity issues. They don't have roll-on container facilities. And there are problems from the ports and getting goods from the ports to the railways. Right? A lot of the links are not there or they're very old. And there are road connectivity problems, and then from the road and the rail to the national systems and then across borders. So lot of very interesting technical issues that go in. Let me show you a few maps, and that kind of helps capture some of that. So here's the sea on the Bay of Bengal, and here are some of the port issues. and what you see, there are these strategic ports that are very important. And a lot of that is, you know, these ports, Yangon, Davao, Chittagong, Kolkata, and then eventually to Sri Lanka and out. So the ports are a big challenge in the Bay of Bengal, right? This is the de facto route because the land corridor is a problem, but these ports suffer from a number of problems. And I haven't even talked about refrigeration, I haven't talked about the container facilities, many, many issues which vary by port. Yeah? Here is the road and rail, you can see the yellow is the rehabilitation path, the parts that need to be rehabilitated, and you can see some of the problems are missing. So you have a road, but it's kind of one track, it can't take the fast tracks, and there are some key missing links that you will see on these maps, a lot of it around Myanmar, which was formerly closed in the past. And you can begin to get a sense of some of the road corridors. And there are three that sort of matter. One is Kolkata, Ho Chi Minh City. There's something called the chicken neck that they talk about in the literature in northeast of India, which is a big problem. Then there is a Chennai, Dawe, Ho Chi Minh corridor, which is a second corridor they talk about. And the third one is the Chittagong, Ho Chi Minh corridor. And then there's a secondary route in Myanmar, which is leading to Da Nang. So there are these different sections of this which are particularly interesting when you start looking at this. The roads exist, but they need some upgrading, and there's lots of technical details in the study. Railway is a critical thing. Remember I showed you this 34 billion number, so the big part of the number is the rail, and the rail is even more problematic. As you can see, there are bits that are missing, and the tracks don't quite work, and so on. And you get a sense of this. I mean, it's a fascinating architecture. Now, the bit that I haven't talked about in all of this is how this all links to China, right? Because that's part of the motor from what is happening. But there was a previous study we did which actually looked at East Asia connectivity that actually did the mapping towards China and so on. And you get even bigger numbers when you bring in China factor into this. The reason we did South Asia and Southeast Asia for this particular study is we wanted to break it down to something that was understandable and actually measurable. Remember, I work for the Asian Development Bank, which is a development bank, and at the end of the day, we care about projects, not just for ourselves, but also for the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank, for the World Bank and others. And so we want to take these big strategic things and break them down into projects of $100 million, $200 million, and begin to think about how to connect these things. So energy trading, essentially the barriers come from technical barriers such as grid synchronization, gaps in natural gas pipelines, different levels of regulatory issues, financial issues. So these were some of the things they tried to capture in this broad heading of energy trading barriers. So some generation, but mostly on the links for the trading issues, across border. How do we get the power across the countries? I want to look at green investments. That would have been a whole different area, but we didn't get to do that. This was more traditional coal and oil-fired generation, a bit of hydro. The green would have required a completely different study. And trying to do this with very little data would have been problematic. So these are all underestimates in some way of some of the important things. And a single power station can cost $500 million, depending on the kind of power station, as you well know. Financing is particularly challenging. Part of the challenge comes that if you get a project, a road that connects two countries, and you point out to a government, let's say you have a small country and a large country, the large country doesn't necessarily see it in its interest to necessarily invest if the small country benefits. So you have this classic market failure issue. The large country would rather connect, let's say, with China. In the minds of the decision makers of the large country would be, why should we bother, say, getting a small country like Laos or Cambodia into the fold when we can build a major highway towards China? So that's the basic problem that occurs. Yeah? People like to connect these big population centers, but from a regional equality point of view, as well as a long-term economic development point of view, you want to try to make sure that there is inclusive growth and trickle down the benefits to all the countries concerned. So that's the biggest problem. So in such a story, with long gestation periods for these types of projects, you either have free riding. So if the big country or the small country builds a road, the other country may decide not to build the other bit of the road. So there you have this classic set of problems, right? Or if you have a development bank that decides to build one part of it, and you have another development bank in another part of the project, national development bank, they may decide not to build the infrastructure. And part of it is the asymmetric information issue. So you realize that you need a mix of instruments. One needs, a lot of this has to be through the public sector still. So the public sector, so the Indian government has a very large infrastructure budget, for instance, or the Vietnam government has the same thing. So that's a core part of this. But increasingly, we would also have public-private sector partnerships as an important issue coming into play in funding some of these with a development bank as a sort of a matchmaker. And some of these types of projects, you might see the World Bank, you might see the Asian Development Bank, you might see the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank getting involved in this. Bond markets are another, and long-term project bonds are another very important vehicle. And you're talking about long-term institutional investors that become very critical. Now, another part of the challenge is that the traffic flows we're talking about and the flows of goods are all potential for the future, right? So the bankers don't see from the private market necessarily the benefits coming around it. So if you want a project that links to China or a project that links to Vietnam, which is a big growth center, fund it straight away. But if it's Nepal or possibly even parts of Bangladesh or northeast of India, why bother? Okay, so that's always the question in the banker's mind, yeah? Particularly when we have these. So government guarantees, multilateral guarantees come into play, long-term project bonds, etc. Very important set of interesting issues on the financing side. So we have PPPs, which are particularly interesting, and we have to tackle both the demand and supply side. And we came to the conclusion that as a vehicle to fund this type of big regional infrastructure program, it will require some test-run projects. The people in South Asia and Southeast Asia are somewhat skeptical, apart from Singapore, about PPPs. And the private sector often very reluctant to take it on. So we need to think of some wins, and probably they're easiest to do in roads because you can earn the money back through the toll roads, for instance. Right? Railway is more complicated because the rolling stock is very expensive. Port upgrading, unless it's a PPP, is even more complicated. And here are some of the things we need to do on the PPP side. And governance always becomes a big question, as well as guarantees and so on. But in the long term, given that private savings are much, much larger than government savings, this is probably the way to go, particularly if you want to connect South Asia and Southeast Asia in the longer run. Now, part of this also is coordination of projects. And development banks are interesting as a kind of honest broker role, and they also provide some kind of knowledge. So a small country, Nepal or Laos, or Sri Lanka might trust the development bank better to give some sort of good advice. Large countries sometimes don't see the need for development banks, but they can play this honest broker role about building confidence, and that tends to be important. Now, the hardware part is only one small part of this. I mean, imagine you can have the railway that connects two countries, right? And imagine there's different gauge widths on either side, and that problem is solved and so on. But then imagine there are lots of customs regulations on both sides of the border, so which might require you to actually take the stuff that comes off the tray, the container, put it into a different type of container or download it into another type of train and move it across. So these trade facilitation issues are terribly important. Likewise, imagine a truck that had plates, say, from Laos or Vietnam or Thailand, and let's say you didn't have a transit arrangement, so the truck can't cross the borders. You just stop the truck at the border, take the goods off the truck, put it on another truck on the other side of the border, get it cleared through customs. Imagine all the delays. So trade facilitation is a really important part of this. And either we have to do a lot of prescription inspection, we have to try to have these single windows. Corruption is another big issue, and rent seeking on the border. So we have to pay as much attention to this stuff as we might pay to the hard infrastructure part of these types of projects. And then we have, you know, the barriers, traditional barriers, tariffs, non-tariff barriers. And there is an interesting proposal, the Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership, which is being negotiated between the ASEAN 10 countries, China, Japan, Korea, Australia, New Zealand, and India. And with the United States deciding that the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement doesn't meet its current strategic interests, and that was the agreement that would link the United States with the factory in Asia, the Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership has become very important today. China is there, India is there, Japan is there, the three big economies in Asia, and RCEP can create potential market which has practically 2.5-3 billion people, and the negotiations are hotting up. There are some controversial issues. India worries a lot about India-China trade, and they worry about absolute advantage. Indian manufacturers think that there is no good that China can't produce cheaper. So this notion of comparative advantage has gone out of the window. And a little illustration of that is very interesting. I was in India recently. I'm not from India, by the way. I'm from Sri Lanka originally, but I've lived here for many years. There was a religious festival in India recently, and beautiful religious statues produced. And guess where the statues were made? Yes. Anybody?
China.
Exactly. Yeah. So you can imagine the horror that even our gods are made in China. Voila. So the absolute advantage notion gets perpetuated, right? In terms of, imagine this at the 6-digit level of all sorts of goods. So that's clearly a contentious issue. The other issue is labor migration, an issue which we see in Brexit, an issue that we're seeing across trade agreements. And it's through with mutual recognition of the skilled people, right? So can a Bangladeshi-trained doctor practice in India? Can a Vietnamese-trained engineer reasonably work in Laos? And can this is a certification looked at carefully? Are the banks that might operate in Thailand, would it be desirable and would they indeed be allowed to operate out of Singapore easily, or do they need lots of licenses? So these are some of the big issues that are there. But RCEP seems a good project, particularly if it reduces tariffs across the ASEAN plus one FTAs, and there are 5 or 6 of these. It harmonizes rules of origin. So we have these 5 agreements that ASEAN has signed with its big trading partners, and if RCEP creates a level playing field of rules, good practices, and has a built-in agenda for more complex issues such as government procurement and investment down the future, it could be an interesting agreement on which, the infrastructure can be built, the facilitation put into place through the single window, and eventually that adopted in South Asia, and eventually reducing trade barriers. So it's part of a big program in some sense. So in summary, we're at this interesting time where globalization is under threat in many ways. But regionalism, particularly in Southeast Asia, can well be alive. And I'm sure Jorgen will talk about ASEAN centrality when we get into the conversation. But people worry about this as an idea, or put forward this thesis that ASEAN centrality can indeed be an important conduit of propelling Asian economic development in the future. And infrastructure is an interesting way of looking at this rather than trade agreements, because trade agreements can bring benefits, but infrastructure's benefits perhaps even greater. And the study shows that you have a $500-odd billion benefit against a price tag of only this amount. And so potentially there is an economic case, but financing can be challenging, and we need the public sector heavily involved to the limited resources they have available, with a much more regional capital market developing and eventually improving the regulatory and other necessary conditions for PPP financing. Coordination is obviously a problem, and in the study we talk a little bit about retooling some of the regional arrangements. There's the ASEAN Secretariat, of course, that may lack some of the technical expertise to do some of this kind of work. There is the EREA, which is the East Asia Research Institute, that has been doing some of this. South Asia, they're more challenging. And then there are cross-regional arrangements as well. So some of the retooling also has to occur, and we need this as well, trade facilitation and liberalization. The book can be downloaded free from the ADB website. This is the edited book, but there's also a report that you can download. We did a deal with Edward Elgar that enabled this to happen. So if you're interested, please go ahead. And there's a whole bunch of papers that you can look at if you're interested. And it's these kind of proposals that led us to also write something for the FT recently, talking about how Asia could be a major player in global trade. So thank you very much.
Well, thank you. This has been really